Hello, and welcome to the podcast, An Intelligent Look at Terrorism. I'm your host, Phil Gursky, President and CEO of Borealis Threat Risk Consulting in Ottawa, Canada. And if you are paying attention, I have talked about immigration and matters related to immigration a bit in the past. And I'm very pleased today to have on the line with me a very good friend of mine, Sean McCoy, who has spent 20 years as a national security analyst for the Government of Canada, in addition to 6 years in the Infantry Reserve. This is the cool part about this, is that Sean is somebody, a rather rare beast in my sort of way looking at things here in Canada. He is the author of a book of fiction we're going to talk about. So Sean, welcome to the podcast.
Phil, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. So you are an author, and the name of your book is called Eastern Horizons. We'll let you walk through my audience what this book is all about.
So the book is based upon a nuclear war between two superpowers in Asia, and the West in Europe is not directly impacted by the war, although, as you can imagine, there's significant environmental and economic damage that's brought to the world with several countries being destroyed.
I've read somewhere that nuclear war doesn't respect borders. It has an impact well beyond that.
Indeed, and I put a lot of research into that, and it's a relatively limited war in as much as in total I have about 520 nuclear weapons being detonated, and that would generate about 10 tetragrams of ash going into the stratosphere. And a lot of the science behind the environmental damage is as far as I can understand, pretty accurate. I put a lot of work into that. One of the impacts of this war was to create what I call a tsunami of refugees, because a conventional war preceded the nuclear war, people did have a chance to get out of the cities. Although several million people were killed, there was also several hundred million people who were displaced. And over the course of the next several months, many of them started to show up in boats off the coast of British Columbia looking for asylum. And then the question that I put to the reader is, okay, Canada, traditionally welcome refugees, but how would we welcome 4 million refugees at a time that there's not enough food to eat and the economy is in freefall?
So in other words, in the aftermath of this nuclear war, as you said, there have been some very well-documented environmental after effects in terms of darkness, in terms of food production. And as you say, Canada, which is a nation that normally takes about 300,000 refugees or immigrants per year, about 1% of the population, now we have 4 million showing up on the doorstep. So what happens next?
Basically, the country goes through a bit of an existential crisis. There's a rise of the political right. Just by coincidence, the war happens in an election year. Kind of a Trump-esque figure from the right arises to try and capture the fear that is gripping the country in the aftermath of this war and in the face of this immigration.
Wait, you're saying that Canada can produce a Trump-like figure? Please tell me that's not true.
Well, I think if we look at Europe, we see that lots of countries are capable of producing populist leaders, and fear is the fuel for that kind of a fire. So a lot of this book is ultimately about fear can grip the masses. And the subtitle of the book is actually Failure and Redemption, a tale of failure and redemption. That's because in my analysis of the book, the one of the characters of the book is Canada, but there's also some human characters in it. There's two naval officers from the Royal Canadian Navy. And everybody kind of goes through their own failure in the aftermath of the war. And the rest of the book is about everybody seeking redemption for that. Canada, the two naval officers, as well, there's a family of Malaysian refugees that I profile as they try to seek safety in Canada from what I call an echo war from the original war in Asia. And as you can see, primary conflicts often spur secondary conflicts. I have a secondary conflict happening in Southeast Asia, which is the Malaysian Civil War. That's the Malaysian refugee family that I pick up and carry through the narrative.
Interesting. So obviously this is in some ways historically accurate, because I'm no historian, but I do know that wars that break out wherever end up causing refugee flows. And, there's conflict that makes people basically have to leave to save themselves and their families from being in the wrong place at the wrong time. We certainly saw that in Syria in the past couple of years. Are there any parallels between what you wrote And the Lebanese crisis that we faced a couple of years ago, where all of a sudden all these people that were in Lebanon who may or may not have had legitimate access to Canada, either through families were seeking to come to Canada. And if memory serves me correct, Sean, there was a huge effort made by the Canadian government to try to vet these people who wanted to come to Canada, to basically get the hell out of Dodge before the situation in the country got any worse.
Absolutely. I was definitely informed in my thinking about the 2006 Israeli-Lebanon war. At the time of that war broke out in the latter half of 2006, there were approximately 40,000 Canadian citizens in Lebanon, overwhelming majority of which were dual citizens. And this was the conflict that spurred the term Canadians of convenience. Mm. A lot of these people, when the war broke out, as you said, rightly or wrongly, sought shelter and went to the Canadian embassy and said, can you please get us out? Ultimately, the government of Canada evacuated 15,000 people out of Lebanon in relatively short order in July, August, and September of that year. And this was a multi-agency undertaking. It was really quite a significant deployment from the Canadian government. Previous to the war in Lebanon, the largest evacuation the government of Canada had undertaken was 500 people after the 2004 tsunami in Southeast Asia.
Wow.
This was 15,000 people.
Are you surprised that, looking back, you know, we Canadians see ourselves as tolerant, as welcoming. Were you surprised that there were voices that were calling these people sort of Canadians of convenience for whom we shouldn't go to Herculean efforts to rescue them? Or is that something that is sort of a natural outpouring of an extreme situation like that and one that's reflected in your book?
I don't think I was surprised by it. I think I was probably disappointed by it. But, you know, the Citizenship Act at the time granted citizenship in perpetuity down the line. So a Canadian citizen, whether naturally born or naturalized, that had children would become Canadian citizens. Their children would become Canadian citizens, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the way down the line in perpetuity. So that after the Lebanon crisis, there were amendments made to the Citizenship Act, Bill C-37, ceased that and basically said that only first-generation Canadians can pass on their citizenship at birth. I think there was a lot of backlash from this. The evacuation cost about $95 million. And there is some indications, some reporting, isn't backed up by government figures, but in the media, that suggested that within a month of the evacuation, 7,000 of the 15,000 people that had been evacuated had already gone back to Lebanon. I did think it created some hard feelings amongst the Canadian population.
Well, as it would, right? If we spend all this money to get you here and then you may immediately turn and go back. You know, listening to you, Sean, it brought back a very distinct memory for me. Before I joined a communications security establishment way back in 1983, I was working as a student translator over in Gatineau. It was called Hull back then. I was doing Spanish to English translation. And the one thing they gave to all the newbies, the students like me, was, I'm not making this up, Mexican Mennonite birth certificates. And what had happened was that there was this time period in which a whole bunch of people from sort of Western Canada, Alberta, Saskatchewan, who happened to be Mennonite, end up back in Mexico. They migrated for a whole host of reasons. And the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren were seeking some kind of Canadian status. They're still in Mexico. So I spent my time translating birth certificates written by very uneducated parish priests in middle of nowhere Mexico, trying to transcribe German Mennonite last names into Spanish. It was quite hilarious. So I think, as you said, there was some sort of animosity and some acrimony when Canadians realized that we went through all this effort, spent all this money to save you people, and then you turned around and went back as soon as you could, which in some ways is natural, right? I mean, Lebanon was their home. It's not as if we should have expected them to, well, we've brought you here. You have no choice but to remain.
Of course, in Canada, we have the constitutional right to, well, notwithstanding the current restrictions on interprovincial boundary movements, we're supposed to have the constitutional right to go wherever we want to go. And certainly we have the constitutional right to leave the country and to return to the country. So I certainly don't fault any of the dual citizens or the Canadian citizens who were in Lebanon at the time. They were well within their rights to seek redress from the government of Canada. They were not a believer at all in dual citizens, or not dual citizens, but second-class citizens, first-class citizens. Like, if you're a Canadian citizen, you're a Canadian citizen. Point finale.
You just said something very interesting, and I want to take this in a slightly different direction, and I apologize for this. You know, under the Charter, Canadians have a right to travel, and they have a right to return. I remember getting into a debate about a year and a half ago at a conference whereby, and this is about the whole foreign, wasn't really about foreign fighters, but it was sort of tangential to that. This person basically argued that the charter right for Canadians to travel implied that the security services like CSIS and the RCMP had no right to prevent Canadians from traveling to join terrorist groups like ISIS. And then they also threw in some kind of 17th century John Locke principles of basic human rights kind of thing. What do you think are some legitimate limits on those types of rights? Does Canada have the right, and I would argue the obligation, to prevent its citizens from leaving this country to go join, let's say, a terrorist group in the Middle East or in Asia?
I think so, right? We're a land of laws, and certainly in the aftermath of 9/11 and subsequent amendments to the Terrorism Act and to the CSIS Act and the Immigration Act, absolutely there are legal limitations now on your ability to do that. And it's certainly a criminal offense to go and do that. And it's not just terrorism, it's a criminal offense to go to exploit minors in a rural country as well, or in a developing country as well. So yes, certainly we accept limitations on the movement of people, but at the same time, even in the case of a foreign fighter, I would be of the position that Canadian citizen, we need to bring that person back. If they're facing justice in Canada, then they can face justice in Canada, but we shouldn't be offloading our problems and saying, well, this person's left. I'm not sure that that's well, certainly not the way the law works, and I'm personally not sure that that's the way we want to run our democracy.
I think there you and I will disagree, because I've gone on record of saying that from my perspective, I think that given that the crimes, at least some of the crimes that were committed by the so-called foreign fighters were in other countries, they should have the first kick of the can, to use the phrase. If you've killed somebody in Iraq or Syria, then, you know, I think Iraqis and the Syrians have a right to try you based on their laws. The problem we're having, of course, is that many of those countries have the death penalty for those types. And we've seen very non-professional, very quick trials in which people aren't allowed to present evidence to, you know, for or against their cases. But I mean, that's certainly another point. Getting back to your book, though, what is it like to write a book of fiction, given the fact you have worked in the national security sphere for two decades now? What are some of the things that made it easier in some ways, and maybe the other side of that coin, made it more of a challenge to write this book?
Totality of my life experience made it easy to write the book. As you said in the introduction, I was in the infantry reserve, so I know the tactical pointy end of the military a little bit. I have a master's degree in military strategic studies, so I understand the theory of war fighting, and in particular nuclear war fighting. But then, you know, having worked for the last 20 years in government, I think I understand how events, just through passively reading for the last 20 years, how events like this would unfold. And I certainly knew, as I was writing the book, what types of questions to ask, what types of Russian and Chinese fighter jets would be squaring off against each other over the steppes, over the Mongolian steppes, for example. And I think that made it easier for me. On the flip side, I had to be very careful that I wasn't betraying anything that I had learned in the course of my work, or to reveal anything that had been classified in any nature. So if you look in that book, there's the word intelligence never shows up in that book or anything like that. Everything I've found on that book is available on the internet, much like Tom Clancy when he wrote The Hunt for Red October back in the 80s. By no means am I equating myself to him. He did a lot of legwork to get everything right.
Let me sort of push that a little bit, because I've written extensively on terrorism. I make no secret of the fact I used to work for the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. Obviously, a lot of what I understand about terrorism as a phenomenon was in fact derived from my work at CSIS. I'm not an academic. I don't look at terrorism from an academic perspective. In your mind, and I know we have to tread very carefully in this line of work. For the record, I have given my manuscripts to CSIS before publication and never had anything taken out, so I must be doing something right. What is that sort of, I don't know, battle between, you know, we are who we are in many ways because of the types of work that we have done, the organizations for whom we worked, the individuals alongside whom we worked. What is that tension like to try to do something that's credible, albeit a piece of fiction in your case, a piece of nonfiction in my case, without crossing that line about actually giving out details that are not available on the public record? And I think we both hew to that line, but the way we interpret things and the way that we present them is certainly informed by where we used to work. How did you sort of manage that kind of tension?
Well, I think on the first part of that question is all federal departments have a departmental security officer, and anybody who's going to be publishing anything that could potentially touch upon their work environment should be running their work through that DSO, the departmental security officer. And I certainly reached out to our officer and advised them of what I was doing and what I was writing, and I had an interview with them, and they said, yeah, we have no problems with what you're saying. So in that sense, I feel quite comfortable with that. But with regards to how things are informed, as I said, there's not a thing in that book that you can't find on Google. How I came to know that, I think it would take a smarter person than me to know whether I knew that because these are the books I read, or I heard it at work, or I heard it in the elevator. But I do know that any of the facts, and although it is a novel, it's very factually based. If I'm talking about a place, you can Google Earth it, and that place is there. And I'm saying this place is good tank country, then you can see, yeah, it's good tank country. That's how I kept myself honest, and any fact in there, I spent hours to make sure it was an accurate thing that I could find on the internet.
Well, kudos to you. I remember having a conversation with somebody, again, going back to this is sort of nostalgia day for me, going back to my start at CSE way back in the early 1980s. And I remember working alongside someone who was slightly more of a veteran than I was. And he would tell me he would never say anything when he went out with friends because he couldn't remember where he learned it from. And he was afraid that he would betray some kind of a deep secret or something like that. And I thought, wow, the fact that you work for an organization, which, by the way, we didn't avow it back then. It was National Defense. It wasn't CSE. Has precluded you from actually talking to anybody in life. And I find that to be kind of unfortunate. But it sounds to me that, obviously you've done your research. You alluded to that, and that so that when you look at the things that are in your book, it would come across as a very realistic depiction of this fictional, albeit plausible, future. So what kind of advice would you give to anybody else that wanted to write something in an analogous vein to what you've done?
Like I said, I think my first step would always be to work with my departmental security officer to make sure that they're on board. Then the flip side would be to informed or not by your work, look in the right places for the information. We spoke earlier in this conversation about the Canadians' Inconvenience and the Israeli-Lebanon War. Pretty much everything I've said to you today came from a May 2007 report to the Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs and International Trade. You just Google that, find it. It talks openly about the fact that multi-agencies were deployed to Lebanon. It mentions in this public report that CSIS was there, that the Department of National Defense was there, that Transport Canada was there. So whatever I think I thought I knew from work, I can read this and be confident that I can say it. Most agencies now have public reports, and I've always been the opinion that if it's published in the public report, then I can say it over a beer with my friends.
It's a really good point. I think that there is a lot of information out there that much more so than I think in the early days, where we were really encouraged very strongly not to say anything at all. And you're absolutely right. There are these public reports that are available. They're available to all Canadians. Maybe some of them are a little harder to find because they're not distributed as openly as other things, but they are out there if you with some simple Google searches. So I have to ask you this, Sean. Now, in the wake of this first novel that you've published, and by the way, what year was it published in?
It was published in March of this year.
Okay, so it's brand spanking new. So again, congratulations. The question I have to ask is there another one in the offing, or would you rather not answer that question in order to build up the excitement and the expectation?
No, I've got a couple of ideas kicking around for potential follow-on novels. One is a book that I've tentatively in my mind called Echo Wars, and that would be about secondary conflicts that are spun out of a primary conflict and how that would impact upon people. And if you were to read my book, you would see throughout it, I have several echo wars around the world. There's what I in the book, I refer to the famine wars in the Horn of Africa. I allude to significant instability in the Caribbean Basin, as well as the Malaysian Civil War. I think I'd like to kind of unpack that a little bit, and again, tie it to history or have history inform it, but at the same time, in an era of which I think this book is really based strongly on Canadian values. And the one thing about this book is unabashedly Canadian. There's references to Americans and British and Australians, but and I'd had people say, if you wrote this from an American's perspective, you'd sell more. And I'm like, well, have a job. I'm telling a story right now.
That's great. As a fellow Canadian, as a friend, I can't praise you enough for doing this. It's nice to have a Canadian voice out there. And you know as well as I do, Sean, that Even in the security and intelligence world, national security world, we're a bit player when it comes, to some of our allies like the Americans and like the Brits. But I've always maintained that we do well better than punch above our weight in terms of our contributions to the community. So the fact that you've been able to do this, and clearly based on our conversation today, it comes across crystal clear that you've married your interest in history, your interest in the military, and your interest in security intelligence. So again, congratulations on the publication of the book. I'm actually going to go out and buy it, and I expect you to sign it when this whole bloody COVID thing ends so I can have my own personalized copy. And thanks for being on the podcast.
That would be great. If you want to buy it, it's available on Amazon. That would be your best place. And it's there's an ebook version and a print version as well.
I'm going to put links to the where you can get it on when I publish the podcast. But I just want to thank you once again, Sean, for taking the time to join me on the podcast.
Great. Thanks so much, Phil.
So that was my conversation with Sean McWaugh, the author of Eastern Horizons. You'll see the links to it on my webpage. I'd love to know what you think of my conversation. Have you written a book of fiction if you work in the security intelligence world? And what kind of challenges did you face? If you've had a chance to read Sean's book, what do you think of it? Did he do a good job of it? You can reach me at any time on email at borealisrisk@gmail.com or on Twitter at borealissaves. You can also find me on LinkedIn and on Facebook. If you'd like to hear more things like this, podcasts, and Today in Terrorism, and all the material that I produce on my website, simply go to www.borealisthreatandrisk.com, hit the subscribe button, fill in your email information, and you'll get a daily digest to your email box every morning without fail. I'll talk to you again soon. Until then, stay safe.